listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
And for the first time presenting, me, Ian Harrison.
So welcome to the team, Ian. You're our local cosmologist in Cardiff, and I can talk about a bunch of other stuff as well as we go through. And the reason you've started this month doing this is because we've had a big conference in Cardiff. We had the National Astronomy Meeting. 660 people, I think, in person, and another couple of hundred remote as well. And that doesn't include the 300 school students you had on one afternoon. So it was a big conference. I guess we'll get onto some stories that have come out this time. But I mean, Edward, you were involved in some of the organisation of the education programmes with me. It was you got to some of the plenary talks, though, the sort of the summary talks, right?
I did, yes. It was actually really nice being involved in such a big conference after so many years of not seeing anybody except on a computer. A few people did come down with COVID and other things afterwards. And I think Ian was one of them. It was really quite wonderful to see people that I haven't seen for, well, some of them I haven't seen for 6 or 7 years. The plenaries, I'm a solar system person, and there weren't many solar system talks in the whole conference, except one of the plenaries talking about the DART mission, which was to launch a spacecraft to divert an asteroid. And actually a double asteroid. It was actually supposed to divert an asteroid's moon. And then the change in angular momentum produced the change in the path of the asteroid itself. So that was really nice to get to see some science that was interesting to me, as well as organizing various different things and trying to print things out at short notice and chase after speakers and that sort of thing.
Yeah, a lot of organization goes into these things. Ian, you were involved on the ground helping do some of the organization locally as well, but in terms of the talks, I guess you focus more on your field, which is the cosmology area. What were the? It's a bit of a in terms of experiments, we're almost a bit of a sort of changing of the guard with cosmology experiments, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the big experiments which have been running for the past, between 5 and 10 years, both in terms of cosmic microwave background and in terms of observations of galaxies for cosmology, things like the Dark Energy Survey and the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, they're kind of coming to the end now and are kind of in the process of producing their final results. And that was, very much reflected in the talks, which were less focused on kind of new results in cosmology and more focused on the kind of techniques and challenges that we're facing and people are solving for these new experiments, which are going to start taking data in the next year or two. Things like the Euclid satellite, which you mentioned launch, and everyone was very excited about that because that had happened the weekend before. And also the Vera C. Rubin Observatory and the Simons Observatory and the DESI experiment as well, all of which are going to start giving us vast amounts of new data in the next year or two.
You mentioned Euclid. I mean, everyone likes a rocket launch. Was Saturday, the 1st of July, I believe, it launched.
Yeah, it's my birthday. It was really kind of the European Space Agency to give me a rocket.
Excellent. It was originally, I believe, the Euclid satellite was going to go up on a Soyuz from the European Space Agency, on a Soyuz rocket from French Guiana. But due to obvious political tensions is an understatement, between Europe and Russia, the Soyuz launches aren't happening for obvious reasons. So it went up on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, which I think is the first time Europe has used a private contractor to launch a satellite. I may be wrong there, but I don't remember any others. And Ian, Euclid, in terms of its science goals, what's Euclid going to teach us about the universe?
Yeah, so Euclid's main reasons for being are the current focuses on very much the current classic problems in cosmology of what really is dark matter and what really is dark energy. So of course we've got lots of observations which tell us about what these things do to the universe in terms of how they make, you know, galaxy clusters clump together, how they affect the expansion of the universe and things like that. But none of what we know about those things we really know to a precise enough level and to a enough detail on smaller scales than the whole universe to be able to tell the difference between different things like particle physics theories, which could be causing dark matter or dark energy. So then Euclid is going to target those things by doing some of the largest surveys of galaxies in the universe which have ever been done, both in terms of very precise spectroscopic measurements of the distances to a smaller subset of galaxies, in order to look at how those galaxies cluster together and what kind of tracing they do of matter on smaller scales. And then also by looking at a much larger sample of galaxies for which we have less certain estimates of their distance away from us, but we don't care as much because there we're just using the galaxies as kind of little test images, and we look at the distortion of the shapes of those galaxies from the weak gravitational lensing effect, which allows us to map the matter. And then the weak lensing survey part of Euclid gives us hopefully a very good map of the matter, and then the galaxy part, the spectroscopic part, gives us a very good map of the galaxies, and then we can then use those two things together to tell us more about these relationships between galaxies and matter, which helps us disentangle different theories of dark matter and dark energy.
And these are, we think of these as the standard or the current problems in cosmology, and they are the current problems in cosmology, but dark matter as a concept came around getting on, what, 90 years ago with observations of galaxy clusters. It started off as things behaving weirdly, and then over the decades, it became apparent that you needed additional mass to explain. There was additional stuff that we couldn't see that was there. But we've got particle physics experiments trying to figure out what it is, but we don't really know what the dark matter is. The observations are maybe giving us a hint. Dark energy, on the other hand, is this weird anti-gravity force that's making the universe accelerate faster. That is less than 30 years old as an observational science, as observational phenomenon. And that's something that we really do have no clue. Are we likely? Are the observations from Euclid, which are looking at how material and how mass is distributed in the universe, going to shed any light on what it might be, or is it just more observational evidence for what it's doing? Do you think?
Yeah. So that's a difficult question without knowing what the result of the survey is, right? Because it very much is the case that the current measurements that we have from, as I say, previous experiments like the Dark Energy Survey and the Kilo Degree Survey tell us with a certain level of confidence, to a certain level of precision, how dark energy appears to be affecting this accelerated expansion. And then people can come up with different fundamental theories which could be causing accelerated expansion as dark energy, but then they might act slightly differently in the details. And then doing this bigger survey with Euclid allows us to focus in more on those details of exactly, you know, how much acceleration happened at different points in the history of the universe. And that might help us tell the differences between these different fundamental theories. So there definitely will be theories which can be ruled out because, you know, as Euclid zooms in on what the particular values of the expansion rate are at different times in the universe, then that will become inconsistent with some of those theories. But it is, of course, not necessarily the case that it will be able to focus on one, right? There are parts of that map of different possible expansion histories which are consistent with many different theories, and we could be lucky, and it could turn out that the observations are only consistent with, you know, one of these fundamental dark energy theories, and that would be great, and that would be almost certainly a Nobel Prize discovery, right? But then the alternative is that it tells us something about the expansion and history of the universe, which is actually consistent with a few different models, and for sure it will rule some out, but whether it will be able to select one in particular. That remains to be seen, right, whether it will be capable of doing that.
So Euclid is going to show us some fascinating stuff about the distant universe. There's been another launch this month as well. So in mid-July, we had a launch targeting something slightly close to home than distant galaxies, the Chandrayaan-3 launch. So this is from the Indian Space Agency, ISRO. Chandrayaan-3 is going to try and do a repeat of what Chandrayaan-2 did. So, Edward, I mean, we can cast our minds back to about, was it 4 years ago-ish to 2019, when Chandrayaan-2 tried to land a lander and a little rover at the south pole of the moon. Didn't quite go to plan then, did it? Hopefully this is going to go better.
Yeah, that's right. And effectively, this is a duplicate of the lander portion. The lander consists of a lander and a rover. So we lost Chandrayaan-2. And hopefully Chandrayaan-3 will be a lot more successful. It's basically exactly the same. I don't think there's any differences. They just went, right, let's just have some new ones. So they have the lander portion, which is called Vikram, and the rover bit, which is called Pragyan. And they were launched only a few days ago, so they're well on their way to the moon, and hopefully they fare better.
And the south pole of the moon is an interesting place because it's got these craters that are permanently shadowed, so they never see any sunlight. And that's of interest, not just scientifically, but perhaps sort of logistically for future missions as well, isn't it?
For me personally, with these exploration type missions, is what's the purpose of going there? Is it just scientific, or is it, and with something as close as the moon, is it the possibility of sending people to the moon? And if you're sending people to the moon, you need to either send a whole load of resources up, or you need to use the resources that are there. And so if there are a whole load of craters that never see light, there's a good possibility that there's quite a lot of water locked in them. And so not only are they pristine from the point of view of that they've got, you know, a nice amount of ice that's frozen there and you can do some science, but they're also, you can use that water for, you know, survival purposes.
So it could well be of use in the future for either robotic missions or possibly for humans, for people to go there. It's a possible good target for crewed missions to the moon, right, the South Pole, because of this prospect of having water ice there, because it could obviously the drinking water, but also can be useful for fuel and
yeah, that's right. Yeah, you can make hydrogen from water just by electrolysis. You just really need a battery and some conductors, and you can produce hydrogen, and then you can have hydrogen fuel cells and things. So you've got really everything that you need except food. You can disassociate water into hydrogen and oxygen. So you need to have a nitrogen source, and then you're away.
I think in terms of the rover, the rover on Chandrayaan-3 is very much a test case. It's not as advanced as any of the rovers that we're seeing on Mars, for example. It's a little sort of tea tray sized thing. It's more like, if people remember Sojourner, the Martian rover, it looks more like that, a little solar panel and a few basic experiments. I think it's a proof of concept in some cases, but this is the first time India will have launched a mission to the moon, and having more people launching more missions is good scientifically, I guess.
Yeah, it's definitely good for science to have different perspectives and not just be ruled by, you know, the space superpowers. It's really great to see that other space agencies can launch really serious missions, but also technology has moved on a lot since people started sending missions to the moon, that you can compress things into a fairly small size and still make them rugged. And obviously if it crashes, it's not going to survive, but you can have a small, like you say, a tea tray sized rover that can still do science. Is quite mind-blowing. It's really like futuristic. If you'd shown that to people in the 60s, they would have thought it was just pure science fiction.
Yeah, it is crazy how things develop. Speaking of things from the 60s that are coming to fruition, we have something that started decades ago. I'm not sure that it was the 60s, actually. That might be too tenuous a link. But something called the pulsar timing arrays, which are doing something very different to any studies of the moon. They're more linked to cosmology. These are radio telescopes that are looking at the timing of very, very precise astronomical clocks, if you like. These are pulsars, spinning neutron stars, with these beams of radio waves that spin around a bit like a lighthouse, and we measure their ticking as these lighthouse beams sweep past the Earth, if the alignment is correct. And they've been doing measurements of these pulsar timing, these pulses, the timing of these pulses, and they found, as they've been looking for they've been taking data now for, I think, 15 years is the longest one. They've been obviously planning this for a long time. They found some interesting signals of gravitational waves, but not the same source of gravitational waves as you've seen before, Ian. So we're used to seeing gravitational waves and combining black holes that are dead stars. This is somewhat larger scale, isn't it?
Yeah. So the kind of signal from gravitational waves that these pulsar timing arrays are just about getting to the verge of making a detection of now is from mergers of black holes, but as you say, not black holes from the collapse of individual stars or anything like that, but from black holes which are, I think, about a billion times bigger than those, which are formed instead of just accretion, so eating lots of stuff over many billions of years, and those are the black holes at the center of galaxies. And because we know something about the history of the formation of galaxies in the universe, and we always see these supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies, we know that when the galaxies merge, which they do very often throughout the history of the universe, the black holes at their centers will also end up merging. And it's very much the same physics that causes the gravitational waves that have been detected by LIGO for a number of years from the stellar mass black holes, that means that when these supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies merge as well, they also give off a gravitational wave signal. That gravitational wave signal from individual mergers is not something that the pulsar timing arrays have detected. Instead, they've detected the kind of background hum of those mergers from the entire history of galaxy mergers at very large distances in the universe. So rather than hearing the extremely loud signal from a nearby, relatively small black hole merger, they're hearing this background hum of many, many, many background mergers of much larger black holes at the center of galaxies after those galaxies have merged across the whole history of the universe, which is pretty cool.
And it's gravity. It's the gravitational wave spectrum, right? So we think of optical astronomy, of looking through telescopes, and then we can think of radio astronomy, which is looking at a different type of light, a different type of electromagnetic radiation. We think of X-ray astronomy and so on. This is exactly the same. We think of LIGO, Virgo, and Kagra looking at gravitational waves of a particular frequency, a particular wavelength. These are just gravitational waves of much longer wavelength, and we learn different things about the universe. It's fabulous to have this next detection. I think, as you said, they're on the verge of detecting it. We tend to think of, in science, the key thing is often a five sigma detection is often called, which is this likelihood of this thing being correct is the it means it's you sort of million to one chance of it being wrong. Million to one chance of it being right, even. This isn't quite at that level yet, and there's different networks of these around the world doing it. And one of them, called NanoGrav, has made this detection, but the European Pulsar Timing Array and so on has made upper limits. They haven't made a detection. It's an interesting timing of making this announcement if they haven't all found it, but it is saying that there's more to come, no doubt, from these future detections. Edward, this can be political as well with when people release these things, because these are big things funded by big agencies. And actually, the the funding from the government or whoever is funding it can actually dictate when people release results, right?
Yeah, and I think that's why we're seeing this sort of non-result being published in such a wide press, because they've obviously been going for such a long time and they're feeling the pressure of other groups working on a similar thing. And they're probably feeling like their other groups are going to pip them to the post. And so they're desperate. Each group is desperate to publish something. So they've gone with this, which is quite a cautious release, and, you know, a hum. It's not exactly earth shattering in terms of, you know, headline grabbing, but it's still significant in what the technology can do. And it's still scientifically interesting in the sense of what the gravitational wave background is. As we tend to think of space-time as, you know, a space being largely empty, but it's of course not. You've got gravitational waves surging through everything all the time. And to get a glimpse on that background of gravitational waves is, I think, extremely, we're in a quite a unique point in history now where that type of thing is possible to talk about. Because we've had actual detections of gravitational waves. If a scientist had tried to make this announcement before the detection of gravitational waves, it would have probably not been accepted in the same context that it is now. It probably people would have found other reasons for this. But it's so obvious now that this is what it is, that it is gravitational waves. So that really will allow us, it's like when you're doing climbing, it's a foothold now to really carry on making discoveries.
And I think one of the interesting things, there are hints that maybe the signal they've seen, the rate of mergers is maybe a bit higher than might have been expected. Really, really, the data on that isn't particularly clear, isn't particularly good yet. So the noise, the statistics on it aren't great. But again, as we said, in a few years, that maybe we'll get more information on that and really start to learn something about the sources of these things over cosmic time. These supermassive black holes that collide in the centers of galaxies can be at very large distances, and they can change with time. They're one of the things that changes with time if we look at them with optical telescopes. So we see these centers of galaxies flaring up as the black holes in the center sort of gobble down material and burp, essentially, as they spew stuff out or out of the poles of these things. We get amazing jets. There was a story, there was a press release at NAM from a group who were following up gravitational wave detections from LIGO and Virgo in 2019 and looking to see if a particular detection had a flash of light with it, and did find a flash of light from an object in the sky. But it turns out to have been much, much, much further away than the gravitational wave signal were. But was interesting. It was a flare-up of something probably in the centre of a galaxy that could have been the turn-on of a galactic nucleus eating material around it and starting to accrete material. It could also have been a star getting disrupted. It's not clear what it was. But these are things that we're seeing, these transient events, these events that change. And again, 30 years ago, you couldn't have imagined doing this kind of stuff, but we have things like the Swift satellite scanning the sky for these events and being able to focus in on them. These galactic nuclei, these active galactic nuclei, are a big thing in radio astronomy, aren't they? And we're trying to study, not just looking at their flashes in optical light, but study them in radio waves as well.
Yeah, absolutely. They have the advantage for radio telescopes of being very bright in the radio. You can use even current radio telescopes to see these things basically across the entire history of the universe where they've existed. So we can really see the first AGN that ever existed, even using current telescopes, because they're so bright. And also because they are the right kind of size for a lot of, again, current radio telescopes to be able to see all the little detail in the images and be able to really get a good picture of the structures in these jets and exactly, yeah, how the active galactic nuclei are feeding on the matter around them and creating these great big burps and jets.
I know you you spoke to someone, I believe a poster winner at NAMM. Poster winner sounds bizarre. Maybe explain the context of what a poster winner is at a scientific conference.
Yeah, I think so. As well as the spoken presentations, the talks that happen at conferences like NAMM, there is always this component where a smaller group of people usually present a poster, so an A0 summary of some work that they have been doing. It's quite often people either earlier in their career or people later on in their career talking about more technical things. And doing these kind of poster presentations is great because they tend to be up all week for the duration of the conference. And there will be specific sessions where people will stand with their posters, so you can wander around at the coffee break or whatever and have a look to see which posters you're interested in, have a read. And if you've got any more follow-up questions and you want to do any more detailed discussion of the poster, then the person presenting the poster will be there and you can chat to them. And it's a great way to really get detailed discussion about things. And it's a great way to network and have a really good overview of what is going on at NAMM in the astronomy community in the UK. So it's a really, really nice thing. And also typically, yeah, there will be a prize. So there will be a set of judges who will go around and look at all the posters throughout the course of the conference and then vote on which one was the best presentationally in terms of interesting science. And then, yeah, there will be prize winners, usually different ones for students and for other early career researchers. And yeah, it's a really nice way of transmitting information and networking when you're at a conference.
And so who did you, tell us who the prize winner was, because this is linked to the AGN stuff, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So the prize winner for the non-PhD student component of the prize giving was Dr. Emma Alexander of the University of Manchester and Jodrell Bank Centre for Astronomy, whose poster was really very visually striking and also very scientifically informative. And yes, it was about these active galactic nuclei and the radio observations that Emma and the team of astronomers using a radio telescope have been making of particular active galactic nuclei and the polarization that is coming from them as well. So yeah, I got a chance to speak to Emma afterwards and congratulate her on that prize. And the first thing I asked her was what these active galactic nuclei are and what her observations have been telling us about what they do.
Thank you for inviting me to speak to you today. It's really nice to be here actually back at NAMM. This is my first in-person conference in a while because of reasons. But yeah, I've been looking at well-resolved radio galaxies. So this is when we have a black hole, an AGN, an active galactic nucleus, in the center of a galaxy. And they release highly energetic jets that will then make their way out to many times the distance of the galaxy that you'd be able to see with the naked eye in the optical. These jets can interact with the intergalactic medium and they create these beautiful lobes, as we call them. So these plumes of these plumes that are very bright in the radio part of the spectrum. So this is why we call them radio galaxies. And specifically, I've been looking at ones which we can well resolve with radio telescopes. So these are the ones that are bigger or closer by or a combination of both. And the idea is to get a detailed view across these lobes and, as Ian said, look at the polarization of them. And that can give us insights into magnetic fields, hopefully not only in the vicinity of the galaxies themselves, but things more local to us, so the Milky Way, that we're looking at them through.
Cool. And so what kind of thing do you learn from being able to see the magnetic fields? Are you looking at maybe what the, I don't know, I'm trying to think of things I know about, like origins of where those magnetic fields might have come from, or are you looking at how those magnetic fields might be influencing the formation of the galaxies themselves, or all of those kind of things?
Magnetic fields are so fundamental to so many astrophysical processes, and they're almost a little bit of a running joke in astronomy, in that sometimes they're a little bit too complicated for people to include in simulations or models. It's part of the NAMM bingo this year, yes, to ask someone if they have considered magnetic fields. So magnetic fields they're everywhere in the universe. We see them in all kinds of scales and physical strengths as well, you know, ranging from things that are as on the scale of things like the Earth's magnetic field, up until magnetic fields that stretch, you know, all the way through a galaxy. And equally, there are magnetic fields that are very, very weak. So, for example, those large-scale intergalactic magnetic fields, very, very weak. And then you get other magnetized objects in the universe that have very, very strong magnetic fields. And the idea of doing a polarization survey, which is what POSSUM is, which is what I work on, it's the polarization sky survey of the universe's magnetism. There's a few Australian projects that I work on named after Australian animals. Okay. I love it. Okay. It's brilliant. Astronomers are brilliant at naming things.
The acronym also works as well in a pleasing way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And the idea behind POSSUM is to capture information about magnetic fields through the Faraday effect. So this is when a polarized electromagnetic wave will have its angle of polarization rotated when it passes through a magneto-ionic medium, so just a bit of stuff that has got electrons in it and has magnetic fields. And so by looking at this Faraday rotation, which we see strongest in the radio because it's a wavelength dependent effect, we can probe magnetic fields along the line of sight from where that polarized radio wave has come from. So what we can do is we can look to see, well, do we think that this Faraday rotation is taking place within the vicinity of the galaxy? And so we can look for things such as skin effects. So is this polarized radio wave being affected as it is coming from the radio galaxy lobe? Or is this something that actually we're just probing the Milky Way magnetic field? So there's quite a few different scales that we need to try and disentangle, but really the aim is just to ultimately understand magnetic fields a bit better, because there are still so many things that we don't actually know in terms of, you know, there are big questions that you can ask about magnetic fields in the universe. Are they something that is intrinsic to the universe? Do they have a cosmological origin? Or are they something that has an astrophysical cause, and you know, that they are because of the galaxies and matter in the universe that generate them? So yeah, they're very important. Still got a lot to learn about them.
Okay. So in your research, which you presented this week as part of the poster, have you been able to favour any potential conclusions about what these magnetic fields might have been, or is it a case of getting used to the data at the moment?
It's definitely still a case of getting used to the data. So POSSUM is being done by ASCAP, which is the Australian Square Kilometre Array Pathfinder Telescope, and it is in full survey science operation mode now, but actually over the course of the past 2 years and during the course of my PhD as well, actually, you know, I started off on commissioning early science data, having a look at that, and then we did a couple of pilot surveys with POSSUM, still processing or just really evaluating the data quality of those. That's the data that my poster here at NAMM was based on. And yeah, so we're going into full survey mode and we're observing with ASCAP. But yeah, there's still a few little things that we just want to make sure about first, because polarization is very tricky. I mean, radio astronomy is pretty can be very complex at the best of times. Yeah, Ian is nodding as well. I think we all face different challenges with radio astronomy. I mean, there are challenges all over astronomy. But then when you go to looking at polarized radio observations, and you're not just interested in the total intensity of radio waves that you're getting, but also the polarization of them, you've got to be very, very careful to make sure that you know what the instrumental effects are, you've got your calibration spot on. Even things like the sun can have a big effect on our radio observations based on, you know, how it affects the ionosphere, and there are far too many things to consider for me to talk about here. So we can get kind of an initial view of the science, and we can get kind of preliminary, we see evidence of these things with these galaxies. But, you know, before making a definite, we have found this, we just need to make sure that we're 100% on what the instrument is doing.
So certainly from what I saw of what you've been showing this week, one of the very striking things about it is the quality of the images which you're showing. They, you know, having looked at many radio images from many different radio telescopes as I have done before, they certainly, you know, by a visual metric, look like really excellent radio images, and the polarization image comes through really clearly as well. So it's great to see these new telescopes starting to deliver these things, and yeah, hopefully we can start using them. Those big science questions.
Yeah, I mean, and ASCAP is a beautiful, beautiful telescope. I love working with it. It's really great for doing survey science. It has something called a phased array feed, which means that it is looking at multiple spots on the sky at any one time, and you can put those spots next to each other in order to make a field of view for the telescope that's much, much bigger than you would usually get for a radio telescope. It's also got pretty good resolution as well, so when we look back to kind of the benchmark radio surveys that they've been over the years, ASCAP surveys are now getting a better resolution of the images, so yeah, we can see things in greater detail. And a really big aspect of polarimetry, polarization radio astronomy science, is how much of the radio you can observe at any one time. What is the bandwidth of your observations, and what is the frequency resolution of your observations? And that is, again, something that ASCAP does beautifully. We can get very large bandwidths in the observations, and that is important for when we're looking at Faraday rotation. I won't bore you with the details, but yeah, more is better, as you might expect.
Always, always. Yeah, that's really good. Thank you very much for speaking to me, and hope you enjoy the rest of the week.
Cool, thank you.
So as well as these detections of active galactic nuclei and studying these things that we've been studying for decades, there are other fields which are, like things like gravitational waves, much, much younger. And one of those is exoplanet science. So discovery of exoplanets, the first of which was discovered just under, about 30 years ago, the first exoplanet, so planets around other stars, was discovered. And we're finding, I think we're now on, actually I haven't looked at the latest number, it's over 4,000, maybe it's 5,000 now, exoplanets.
It's almost 6,000.
Is it almost 6,000? Wow, I'm 2 weeks out of date or something. Yeah, it's going up very rapidly. There was a discovery from the, and I think we have different ways of saying this, I would say KEOPS satellite. Edward?
I would say KEOPS as well.
Okay. Ian?
I went with CHEOPS, but I have no intrinsic knowledge.
So someone at some point can maybe write in and tell us how it's pronounced. So the CHEOPS or KEOPS satellite is a European Space Agency satellite that's studying exoplanets. And it's found, it studied a planet found by the a NASA satellite, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite, TESS. This one is, I think for the first time in a while, the first new type of exoplanet. So we have super Earths that are a bit bigger than the Earth. We have hot Jupiters, which are like Jupiter, the size of Jupiter, but very close to their star, and so very hot. We have, but this time we have a super hot Neptune. So this is something that's about five times the size of the Earth, but orbits much, much, much closer to its star than the Earth does, so is much, much hotter on its surface. Now, ordinarily, that would involve the atmosphere being blown away, essentially, by the radiation, the winds from the star. But the evidence seems to show this has a almost a metallic atmosphere. Now, we're not talking solids, you know, a metal case around this thing. This is droplets of titanium. And Edward, these exoplanets, every time we think we've found something weird and wonderful, there's something more weird and more wonderful that comes out.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably a Dyson sphere, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe.
So exoplanets are weird, and it's extremely interesting studying exoplanets. I've studied exoplanets quite a bit. That really what you're looking at is not a direct measurement of... in most cases, a direct measurement of the atmosphere of an exoplanet. You're inferring, or the temperature of it, you're inferring what it must be from what you know about the star and what you know about the exoplanet. And that's normally from looking at how much the star dims as the exoplanet transits, goes in front and causes an eclipse, or combined with how much the planet induces a wobble in the motion of the star itself. And those combined tell you things about the exoplanet, as well as looking at then the orbital period. So you can find out the distance that the exoplanet is away from its star, how big the exoplanet is, and what the mass of it is by those three measurements. And if you know what its mass and its radius is, you can work out what its density is, and then you can start the big problem of working out from a density what its structure is likely to be. And so ones with a very high density are probably going to be rocky, so Earth-like ones, super-Earths. And ones that have a very low density are going to be Jupiter ones or Neptune ones. And if you know, obviously Jupiter ones are going to be the larger physical extent ones, so ones with a larger radius. And Neptune-sized ones are going to be smaller. And this one is so close to the star that the surface temperature is about 2,000 degrees, which is not good for any planet. And as you said, Chris, the planet is going to be bombarded by radiation, not only light radiation, but particle radiation from the star itself. All stars have a wind of charged particles that flow away from them. Our sun does as well. And that's what causes the northern and southern lights. And if the planet is much closer, then it's a lot more intense. So there must be something shielding the planet so that it's not, like you say, the atmosphere isn't blown away. And one of the things that fits with this idea of building up the structure of the planet is that there are droplets of water, of there are droplets of some sort of metal in the atmosphere, rather like water vapor, but some sort of metal that's reflecting not only light and the radiation, the light radiation, but also the physical radiation.
And this sounds crazy, but if you imagine standing in a hot and sort of steamy bathroom when the shower's been running and the atmosphere is thick with water droplets, this is that kind of thing where the atmosphere is so full of things like titanium is one metal I think they think could be there, but also then silicates. So silicon is what makes glass. And you end up with the atmosphere super saturated with these droplets of this material. So it's raining titanium and raining droplets of glass on this planet, and they're reflecting all the light. So it's stopping the atmosphere kind of evaporating away too quickly. It really is a bizarre to imagine what it must be like. To be on this or anywhere near this planet. I don't think we could go there. It's probably not too hospitable.
I also wonder if we're completely wrong about this, and it seems so crazy that if we get more measurements of it in perhaps with other telescopes that are coming up in the future, and we'll actually be able to obtain a spectrum of the planet's atmosphere, we'll learn more about what's going on here.
Mm. It is bizarre. I mean, they found this because they noticed that the planet is reflecting something like 80% of the star's light. So it's very, very reflective, which, as you say, is helping protect the atmosphere. So that makes it a bit like Venus. Venus has a very reflective atmosphere as well with its thick clouds. And I don't think you'd expect that from a rocky surface without any.
Exactly.
So there's lots of signs. But as you say, they refer to this as the planet that shouldn't exist, which does hint that maybe we're missing something, that we haven't found planets of this mass near their stars. And if you haven't found many of them, it either suggests that for some reason they can't form or that they change very rapidly. So maybe this planet is in the process of being eroded away. Maybe this is a transient part, a short part of its life, and actually it's going to get all the atmosphere blown away and then leaving just a rocky core. I'm completely speculating because it's not my area of science, but there's all sorts of things that could explain this that, as you say, for future information will highlight.
Yeah, and planets don't stay in their fixed orbits for the entire life of the solar system. They do migrate. They do move. They can form in a different place to where they spend the majority of their life. So, like you say, we could be just capturing the rare, you know, the 1 in 6,000 event of a planet in the process of being evaporated.
Which would be fascinating. Now, this is a field that's very, very new. So the first exoplanet discovered was not actually around a sun-like star. It was around a neutron star in 1992. And the first sun-like star was 1995. So that's about 30 years ago. One of the plenary talks, one of the summary talks, was given by Dr. Hannah Wakeford from the University of Bristol, who'd come all the way over the Bristol Channel to Cardiff to attend the conference. And I asked Hannah about the state of the field. And I began by putting to her talk 30 years ago would have been quite a lot shorter, and asked her how things had changed and what we were learning at present.
So you're right that 30 years ago it would have been very short. There had been two planets potentially discovered around a dead star. There wasn't even a exoplanet that existed around a sun-like star, a star that we could say is in its main lifetime. So they didn't exist. It's a really new field in astronomy itself. So we are constantly learning things, but one of the biggest shifts that we're seeing recently in what we're learning and how we're learning it is with the launch of JWST, this giant 6.5-meter gold-plated telescope that was sent a million miles from the Earth to examine, view the universe right from the earliest stars forming all the way up to our neighborhood planets. And that's what I look at. I look at these exoplanets, planets that orbit stars other than our sun. So these are outside our solar system, orbited around the stars you see in the night sky, trying to understand what their atmospheres are like, because that can tell us a little bit about their environments and what the nature of those worlds really is.
And because most of the discoveries we've had to date, there have been, to discover exoplanets, two main methods which tell us about the size or the mass of the planet.
Yeah.
And that tells us something about the planets, but not everything.
So those two measurements are really important. We measure the size of the planet, so its radius from the transiting technique. This is looking at the planet as it passes in front of the star. It causes a shadow. And from that shadow, we can measure the size, the area it's blocking out. We then use the radial velocity technique, which is looking at the spectrum of a star and seeing how it shifts as it moves towards us and away from us by the pull of a planet orbiting around it. So think of, we're going to use a swing ball set in your garden. You anchor it down, but you're hitting that tennis ball round on that string and it's pulling it around in this slight oscillation. We measure that for the stars to get the masses of the planets, because that can tell us how much of a pull that planet has on the star. Combined, those tell us something about the bulk density. So it can tell us if that planet is probably mostly rock or mostly iron, or it's actually more like a gas giant and its atmosphere is dominating the material that make it up. So we get basic properties.
And even that, so in our solar system, we have the four inner planets, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars, which are balls of rock.
Yep.
And we have the four outer planets, so Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, which are mostly gas.
Mostly gas in terms of their mass that makes them up, yes.
And what do we see in terms of even those basic parameters with exoplanets around, so planets around other stars? Do they fall into those two broad camps, or are there something in the middle?
So it's really nice to see when we look at the 5,000 plus exoplanets that have been discovered that there is this beautiful distribution across all of those categories. So this whole wave of planets from these rocky planets through this transition between rocky and gas dominated that we don't understand at all, out to these gas giants from the smallest, those Uranus and Neptune sized, up to the Jupiters. So we're actually seeing a distribution across all sizes and masses. And that represents a lot of things we don't have in our solar system. So our solar system is not a great representation of all the kinds of planets that exist. So looking at these 5,000 plus exoplanets, we can start to understand that continuum, essentially, this kind of beautiful spectrum of different planets that are out there. But unlike our solar system, they're in very different environments. So in our solar system, like you just said, we've got our inner planets and our outer planets, rocky, then gas dominated. That's not necessarily what we see in exoplanets. We don't necessarily have this beautiful division. We see gas giants inner and some rocky planets outer. In many cases, we're looking at planets that orbit their stars much, much closer than those in our solar system. So a lot of the planets that we're able to understand their atmospheres orbit 20 times closer to their stars than we do to the sun.
Wow. That must, I mean, intuitively, that must be quite warm if you're 20 times closer to the sun, if it was the sun, I guess.
Yeah, that's the key part there. If it was the sun, that would make you very, very hot. But we have all different kinds of stars that these planets are orbiting. And you can get stars that are a tenth the size of the sun and over half their temperature. So they're much, much cooler, smaller stars. So if you put a planet on the same distance, then it's going to be cooler because the star's not outputting as much energy. So the star that the planet is around is incredibly important to the whole environment that it's in.
And so we've got planets of all sorts of masses and sizes. Do we find a range of densities? So, I mean, we know the density of rock, we know the sort of density of the gaseous stuff. Do we find stuff in between? I mean, we've got the three phases of matter. We think of a solid, liquid and gas. I mean, do you get liquid planets? Is that a silly question? Or?
So we think you might be able to get what we would call ocean worlds, things that are dominated by a liquid or their atmosphere is so thick and dense, it's more soupy. You can think of Venus's atmosphere like a little bit of a soup in that way. There's a lot of small droplets of sulfuric acid in Venus's atmosphere. Those are suspended in the gas, but they dominate in what that planet is like and what the environment is like. But we've also got some really odd densities for these planets. So there are a certain type of exoplanet called the superpuffs.
Right.
They have the density of styrofoam or candy floss.
Okay.
They are incredibly low density. And to get that kind of material, we genuinely don't quite understand what's going on there. So there's a lot of observations that will be done in the coming years with JWST to look at the atmospheres of these planets and see if things that we're measuring for their atmospheres can tell us a little bit about how and why they have such a low density.
And so you mentioned that the JWST is going to be looking at the atmospheres of the, these things. What are we finding with JWST? And I guess perhaps as importantly, what are we not going to find? What's left to find? I mean, is JWST going to solve exoplanet science?
No, JWST is not going to solve exoplanet science. There's your kind of title for you. It's really amazing what we're finding. We are hitting what I call the paradigm shift. We are learning so much that we have never had access to before. JWST is an infrared telescope, and that means that we get access to all different kinds of gases. In particular, we get access to what we would call greenhouse gases. So things like water is a greenhouse gas. CO2, we're very familiar as a greenhouse gas, but also methane as well. And the reason why they're called greenhouse gases is because they absorb infrared radiation. They absorb heat, because that's what infrared is heat. So we can now, with this heat-seeking telescope, we can look for these types of gases that we haven't had access to before. But it cannot look in the ultraviolet or the optical part of the spectrum. So JWST alone can't tell us the whole story of these planets. And the reason why the UV and optical is so important is because the UV part of the spectrum is where all of the chemistry that goes on, so the way that those gases interact and form different particles, happens in the ultraviolet. So we need to understand these planets in the ultraviolet. And then if we think about the optical and we think about the Earth's atmosphere scattering in the blue, it's a very blue atmosphere. Yeah. When we have a nice day, as we do today in Cardiff.
Yeah, lovely.
That has to be measured in the optical. And we can't access that with JWST. So one of the things that I work on is pairing observations between the Hubble Space Telescope, which operates in this ultraviolet optical portion of the wavelength space, with JWST, which gives us access to all of these different molecules. And combining that information, we can start to build a really clear picture of what the environment, the nature of these really strange planets is.
If we recorded this interview in, say, 5 years' time or so, we wouldn't be talking about the groundbreaking discoveries that JWST is making, although hopefully it'll still be making discoveries at that point.
It definitely will.
But we'd be talking about things like Ariel, which is the next big mission from Europe going to study exoplanets, but specifically to study exoplanets. Is there an advantage to that? What's that going to teach us, do you think, that JWST is not, or is it just part of the complementary nature of science?
I think it's a big part of the complementary nature of science. So JWST is going to operate for up to 20 years it's able to operate with the amount of fuel it has to do its pointing and stay in orbit. So we're going to be able to survey or look at hundreds and hundreds of planets in detail to examine their atmospheres. And that's kind of the job that Ariel wants to do as well. And the way that Ariel can be complementary to that effort that we can do with JWST is to be looking at types of planets that maybe are harder for us to understand and study. Because it's a dedicated mission, it can stare at certain targets multiple times to build up that information.
Right.
Whereas JWST is for everybody and for all astrophysics. So it's covering things like galaxies, it's covering the birth of stars in our universe, star formation, dust and molecular clouds, and a whole host of different subjects. So the amount of time is limited, but really gives us a huge amount of information. By having a dedicated mission like Ariel, we can really hammer down and look at those planets that we might not be able to access otherwise.
We're talking about these missions that are going to characterize exoplanets and tell us what their atmospheres are like. But for the past 25, 30 years, the effort's been on finding exoplanets. So we had various ground-based telescopes, then of course we had Kepler. We've now got TESS is up there. There's Plato and all these missions that are launching to go and try and find exoplanets. Are we moving? I mean, we've got 5,000 other things, right? Is there still benefit in finding more of these things? Or should we, you know, are astronomers kind of thinking, let's stop looking, we've got 5,000, it's a decent enough sample, let's study those in more detail?
There's a huge amount of value in continuing to look for these planets. The types of worlds that we've discovered so far do not meet the demographic of our solar system at all. We haven't got overlap in the types of worlds that we see in our backyard.
Right.
And one of the key things when we're looking at number statistics is me asking the question, is 5,000 stars enough?
Right.
Is 5,000 galaxies enough? In a single deep field image, you've got over 5,000 galaxies in there. So we should stop. And I think it's one of those things that you've got all of these numbers, but it doesn't make sense until you can put it into pure statistical context. So we have to keep looking because we don't yet have the full picture. When we're looking at these exoplanets, we're looking at the nearest things to the sun. We have looked in our very, very tiny portion of our galaxy. There's a huge amount of differences in the environments close to the galactic center, further away, above and below the galaxy itself. Do we find planets everywhere? And those are questions we are yet to answer. But with missions like the ones you mentioned, but also the Roman Space Telescope, which will be doing what we call micro-lensing, so looking for invisible planets.
Right. So we don't see them directly, we see their impact.
We see their impact on the light, the way that they bend the light due to their mass. And from that, we're hoping we can access as many different planets on all kinds of orbits, all kinds of distances that we can't get with traditional methods.
I'm going to ask one cheeky question at the end. Are we going to find the exomoons?
I don't know. I think, I'm certain they exist, but they don't currently exist in a detectable phase space.
So they're too small. We're not looking, we can't study those kind of sizes or masses or timescales or...
Exactly. So it's not an easy thing to do. So think about all the moons of Jupiter. We still don't know. I don't think we know them all.
Well, I think we just a couple of months ago we found another 60 moons of Saturn or something. I can't remember what the number is.
Something ridiculous like that. That is next door to us in astronomical terms, and it's really, really tough to do. So try doing that on a pinprick of light, which is then being blocked out by something smaller and smaller and smaller. So it's a really, really tough thing to do. I think they exist. It's about how can we find them and what is the main scientific driver for finding them as well.
Okay. What's your hope for the thing we discover in exoplanet science? Your dream of what we're going to find next?
I am really looking forward to making multi-dimensional maps of these planetary atmospheres to understand how the winds influence the chemistry and change the way in which we understand how and why what we're seeing can teach us something.
So you could imagine, you can get close to imagining being there, I guess, if you know what
exactly. These planets are with. And taking that information and being able to translate it to other planets, using that to make predictive models for what we should see. Do we see that? Break it down into the pure scientific thing of, here's my question, how can I test that hypothesis and what can I learn further from that?
Excellent. Well, Dr. Hannah Wakeford, thank you very much. We look forward to all the upcoming discoveries from JWST and all those other missions as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
So that's just a little bit of what was going on at the National Astronomy Meeting. There'll be more next month, and Ian managed to get some interviews with a few other people at the conference. That's it for this month, though. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk. And you can also find us on Spotify. Just search for Pythagorean Astronomy or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to our guests, Dr. Emma Alexander and Dr. Hannah Wakeford. And of course, thanks to Ian and Edward. Until next month, goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.